Welcome to the Theology Mill podcast brought to you by Wippenstock Publishers. My name is Zach Mickle. I'm on staff here at Wippenstock, and I am the host of this podcast, which consists of interviews with leading authors and thinkers in theology, biblical studies, and philosophy. If you like what you're hearing on our podcast, come stop by our website at wippenstock.com, where you can browse our catalog of books and journals, and you can also check out our blog there. So in this episode, I speak with Nicholas Denisenko, who is the Emil and Elfried Joachim Professor and Chair at Valparaiso University. He's the author of The Orthodox Church in Ukraine, A Century of Separation, published in 2018, and more recently of two books with Cascade, the first being This is the Day That the Lord Has Made, The Liturgical Year in Orthodoxy, and then most recently, The Church's Unholy War, Russia's Invasion of Ukraine and Orthodoxy, which is the book we'll be speaking most about in this interview. So with that, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you enjoy this conversation. So I am here with Dr. Nicholas Denisenko, who is the author of a couple new recent Cascade books, but the one we're going to be talking about today is his book, The Church's Unholy War, Russia's Invasion of Ukraine and Orthodoxy, which is very, very timely book. But before we get started, Professor Denisenko, could you just tell me a little bit about yourself, what you do, and how you kind of came to study the relations between Ukrainian and Russian Orthodox?
Yes, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to talk about my book, about my research, and to contribute to the larger discussion on this matter. I'm actually a trained liturgical scholar. I have my PhD in liturgical studies from Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., and have been teaching liturgy and sacramental theology and researching in that area since 2003, when I started my doctoral studies. Back in when I was a seminarian at St. Vladimir's Orthodox Theological Seminary in 1997 to 2000, in our church history unit, we worked on narrating and composing and writing church history through oral history by meeting with people who were eyewitnesses, who were participants in important events or knew of them or had some kind of accumulated historical knowledge about them. And it struck me that we did not have much material in English about the history of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. And, you know, this was just a few years following the fall of the Soviet Union and the beginning of important changes in the church scene in Ukraine in particular. So when I was a seminarian, I wrote fairly extensively. I did a project on this oral history, and I ended up publishing it into a paper in St. Vladimir's Orthodox Theological Quarterly. And then during my doctoral studies and afterwards, as post-Soviet history continued to move on and there was movement and changes in the church scene in conjunction, in rhythm with the political scene in Ukraine and between Ukraine and Russia, I intensified my interest in the topic, largely because my grandfather was a priest in the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. Mm. I collected a large amount of periodical material, of self-published material from the Ukrainian church during World War II. And this was the Ukrainian church that found its origins in Poland and came to be one of the two churches in Ukraine during the Second World War from 1942 to 1945. And so I was trying to answer some questions that had been posed by a number of different scholars, but in particular, people who were interested in the dynamic and the tensions between the Russian Orthodox Church and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. And so I turned to some of the sources that I had both remembered and collected from his office. And I also used the relationships that I had and my memory of these events to start writing on the topic. And it just kind of snowballed into an important area of research for me. It's really my primary area of research now, and that's the church in Ukraine. So after the initial article that I had published in St. Vladimir's Orthodox Theological Quarterly, I published several articles on the role of the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine and on a variety of issues in the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, really beginning in 2011 and onwards. And that turned into the publication of two books. One, The Orthodox Church in Ukraine, A Century of Separation, with Northern Illinois University Press. And the second one is with you, with Cascade, The Churches on Holy War, which is recently published. My first book was translated into Ukrainian as well with some additional material. So my sense is that I will continue to work on this topic far into, for many, many more years, hopefully, and hopefully to retirement and even beyond. I have a couple of projects I'm already starting to gather notes for that will certainly continue my work in this area.
Awesome. Awesome. Have you spent time in Ukraine or Russia?
I've never been to Russia. I visited Ukraine for the first time in 1993 with my grandfather and my brother. That was just 2 years following the declaration of Ukrainian independence and the establishment of a sovereign Ukrainian state. So my grandfather, and actually all of my grandparents, came from Ukraine. My grandfather was born and raised there, and we went with him. For him, it was the first time he had been there in 50 years when we went to 1993. And I was fortunate enough to go again on a couple of occasions in 2016 and also in 2019. I was supposed to go in 2021, but because of both personal circumstances and COVID, that trip was delayed. And who knows when I'll be able to go back, yeah. But I've always made good use of those trips to Ukraine for research and for networking and also to visit friends and colleagues.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Wonderful. Okay. Well, before we get further into your book, let's start with our icebreaker question, which I ask all of our guests, which is if you could place three figures in a room, dead or alive, all together around a table, and you could kind of be a fly on the wall and listen to their conversation, who would you choose and why?
That's such a great question. And I'm tempted to put football figures, like NFL football figures, into the answer because I'm a big fan of NFL football. Okay. But I think that for my purposes, the people that I might put in a room would include Alexander Schmemann, Maria Skobtsova, and probably someone like Nicholas Afanasyev, which takes us a little bit astray from the Ukrainian issue, but plants us squarely into people who had a sense of the pulse of needed changes in the Orthodox Church and who attempted to research the history of the church, a history of church structures, and to kind of blend in theology with the kinds of changes that were occurring and to push the Orthodox Church forward into making necessary changes. I would love to have them in a room together to listen to their conversation, and they're all departed now. But to hear their reflections on what they experienced. Maria Skobtsova is now Saint Maria of Paris, and she died in Ravensbrück, taking the place of a Jew who went on a train to the gas chamber. And I would love to hear their experiences of war, of emigration, of navigating these seismic changes in church and society and orthodoxy. And so much has happened since they departed this world. They seem to have their finger on the pulse of change. And how would they have responded to all of the changes and challenges that are confronting the Orthodox Church today? I would love to hear their responses. I look up to all three of those figures very much as exemplars of how to conduct the good life and to be courageous in the face of seismic changes and challenges.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've read a bit of Schmemann, but I'm not as familiar with the other two. So maybe for me, but also for our listeners, could you say just kind of in brief a little bit about each of the three figures that you named?
Absolutely. Yes. Nicholas Afanasyev was a priest who wrote two important books and a number of very, very important articles on ecclesiology, engaged in ecumenical dialogue with the Roman Catholic Church, and who essentially was one of the people who spearheaded, pioneered the restoration of what we might think of as Eucharistic ecclesiology, being that if you want to know where the church is, you see the church when it's gathered together for Eucharist. A very important figure. His book, The Church of the Holy Spirit, has been translated into English, published by Notre Dame Press, translated by important people who are working in the field today, like Deacon Vitaly Permyakov, Father Michael Plekon, among others who worked on this project. Alexander Schmemann, of course, is very well known as being the dean of St. Vladimir's Seminary and one of the fathers of the movement of liturgical theology. His life was seemingly too short. I leave that to God to decide, but his legacy continues to live on today, a legacy of a vision for what it means to be church and someone who inspired multiple generations of clergy and laity and orthodoxy to really kind of live out the Eucharist as the church, this notion. Afanasyev was one of the people that inspired him, but there are others like Father Kyprian Cairn and Father Sergius Bulgakov. Bulgakov, of course, is another well-known Orthodox theologian. Schmemann's legacy is important to outside of America as well. And I would call attention to a friend of mine who wrote a book on correspondence between Schmemann and George Florovsky. And it's Paul Gavrilyuk, who is also the president of the International Orthodox Theological Association. Now, St. Maria of Paris is well known to Orthodox insiders largely because of her eyewitness account. And many of her works appeared in the journal Puch, or The Way, which was published by the Russian emigre community in Paris. She was a participant in the life there, but I think the most important legacy for her is this new vision that she had for monasticism, for embracing others, for seeing the world as one's monastery, for understanding that the basic principle of monasticism to love God, to pray 24/7, to serve one's neighbor is to be lived out in the world. And she's beloved in many different places in the world because of the way that she bore witness by giving her life for a Jew during World War II, and also for serving those who were in need in Paris. Many people have focused on her life. A friend and colleague of mine, Father Michael Plekon, who's also published with Cascade, has written extensively about St. Maria of Paris as well. So I think that their legacy lives on among many Orthodox who have the courage to confront the challenges of today.
Sure. Thank you for that. It sounds like a delightful conversation. Okay, so before we get into what we're going to talk more about, which is kind of the connection between the role of just kind of the ecclesial history between the Orthodox churches in Ukraine and in Russia on the one hand, but then also Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022, over a year ago, and then kind of the ongoing attacks in Ukraine. On the other hand, I thought it might be just good to establish for our listeners who may not be as aware, and frankly, one of the only reasons I'm as aware as I am, which is still not much, is because I read good portions of your book. But I thought it might be good to establish some of the kind of main ecclesial bodies and the figures that are kind of involved in this story. So if you could just say a little bit, I know it's quite a complex picture, but what are kind of these main ecclesial bodies, would you say, on the scene in both Russia and Ukraine? And then how would you kind of describe their recent history?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it is complex, and I'll do my best to keep it as clear as possible. Let's start with Russia. We have the main entity in Russia is, of course, the Russian Orthodox Church. It's also known as the Moscow Patriarchate. And patriarchate is a status of dignity that is given to some of the Orthodox churches. Not all. There are 15 autocephalous or completely independent in governance and administration Orthodox churches that are held together by common core values, basically sharing the same faith and the willingness to share Holy Communion with one another and all of the other aspects of the sacramental life. And the Russian Orthodox Church has the dignity of a patriarchate that was bestowed upon it in the year 1589. So sometimes we call it the Russian Orthodox Church, and sometimes we call it the Moscow Patriarchate. And they're essentially the same thing. And in terms of the role of the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine, this will be the briefest historical narrative ever recorded on this topic. Christianity was established in Ukraine at the toward the end of the 10th century by the Patriarchate of Constantinople, when Prince Volodymyr, or Vladimir, however one wants to pronounce his name, arranged for the baptism of the citizens of the Principality of Kyiv into the Orthodox faith, and for much of the history of medieval Kyiv and the other city-states of Rus, the church was subordinate, was part of the Patriarchate of Constantinople. And essentially what happened was that these city-states were vulnerable to attacks from foreign entities. So for example, in the year 1240, the city-state of Kyiv fell to the invasion of the Mongolian Golden Horde. And it was difficult for them to sustain a vibrant church life during that time period. And what happened was a stronger city-state to the east, Vladimir Suzdal, and eventually Moscow, were able to sustain that church life. Even though they weren't really one people, these city-states, they were rivals with one another. They often waged war upon one another. And so one cannot basically say that, well, they all constituted one nation. It's kind of an important historical debate among scholars of Ukrainian and Russian history. But ultimately what happens in the church scene, and this is why it's important, is that in Kyiv, when it comes under first Lithuanian and then Polish-Lithuanian rule in the 14th century, Orthodox church life resumes there. And then they're challenged by Catholic pressures. And in the year 1596, incidentally, 7 years after the Russian Orthodox Church becomes a patriarchate, has nothing to do with that really, the bishops that were governing the Orthodox Church of the people who were of the Kyiv Church decided to enter into union with the Roman Catholic Church while they reserved their rights, and it became known as Unia. It's known as the Union of Brest in 1596. And what happened was that the majority of the Orthodox laity did not accept this union. And eventually in the early 17th century, they reestablished Orthodox body of bishops. But by the time that you get to the near the end of the 17th century, the Russian Orthodox Church, in conjunction with the monarchy in the Russian Empire, are making overtures to the Patriarchate of Constantinople. to assume what's essentially church governance over the church in Kyiv, which would have at that time encompassed certainly Ukrainian people, but also Belarusian people as well. And there was a disagreement on what the terms of that governance would be. Constantinople thought that they had simply given the Patriarch of Moscow the right to ordain the Metropolitan of Kyiv, which is essentially the chief bishop of the church in Kyiv. Whereas monarchs, the Tsars, and the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church believed that it was a complete assumption of governance over the entire church of what was then Ukraine and Belarus. And so at the end of the 17th century, this event occurs that's contested historically, where these people who had been under the leadership of the church in Constantinople are gradually, over the course of a number of decades, absorbed into the structures and the culture of the Russian Orthodox Church and the Moscow Patriarchate, which is why that church is so important as part of the larger imperial political policy, the political scheme. They slowly Russified the church life in Ukraine and Belarus as well. And examples of that include making the Russian language the language of instruction in the seminaries during the period of the Russian Empire. Now, there was no way for Ukrainians to kind of vie for their own independence, to assert their own independence until the revolution of 1917. Ukraine vied for independence, and it also launched a movement for strong church independence. And here's where the story gets really short. From essentially 1917 until 2018, there are a number of attempts on the part of Orthodox Ukrainians to basically create their own independent or autocephalous Orthodox Church to be free of subordination to the Russian Orthodox Church. And this occurred in 1921, and it occurred again in 1942 during the German occupation. And it occurred one final time in 1989 at the end of the Soviet era during Gorbachev's spirit or policies of glasnost and perestroika. And the one of 1989 pretty much held because Ukraine became independent and essentially adopted tolerance of religious pluralism. And so basically what you had in Ukraine, the very end of the Soviet era to the very beginning, was two competing Orthodox churches, one completely independent or autocephalous, and then the Russian Orthodox Exarchate in Ukraine. And by 1992, there were three churches in Ukraine because the independent one split into two. And the two churches that were in competition with one another were the Kyiv Patriarchate, a self-proclaimed patriarchate that proclaimed itself a patriarchate in 1992 at a council in Kyiv, and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which claimed to be autonomous but not completely independent of the Russian Orthodox Church. And what happened was that there were many attempts on the part of Ukrainian presidents to eliminate religion as a potential divisive community in Ukrainian society by asking those churches to unite into one and to be completely independent of the Russian Orthodox Church. And those attempts to create structures like that failed largely because they didn't have the support of an authoritative figure among the other Orthodox churches. But that changed in 2018 when, to the surprise of Orthodox observers, the Patriarch of Constantinople, who is kind of viewed as the first among equals, some say the first without equals, depending on which point of view one adopts, came in and said, "I am going to use the special privileges granted to my office to grant autocephaly to the Orthodox Church of Ukraine." And it was a messy process, but by the end of 2018 and the beginning of 2019, they created an independent Orthodox church that was recognized by some of the other Orthodox churches as completely legitimate, lawful, and autocephalous or independent, now known as the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, ruled over by Metropolitan Epiphany, who was elected at a unification council at the end of December 2018. The problem was that they were hoping to unify all of the Orthodox churches, and a slight majority, but a majority of the parishes and bishops opted to remain as part of the Russian Orthodox Church. These are led by Metropolitan Onufri, who is the leader of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church that I mentioned before, that remains subordinate to Moscow, but claimed to be mostly independent, autonomous. And if that isn't confusing enough, that leads us to the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022, where just a few months after that, this church under Onufri that had been autonomous convenes a council, criticizes the Russian Patriarch Kirill and the politics of the Russian Orthodox Church, condemns Russian aggression, and claims that they are now completely independent in their administration from the Russian Orthodox Church. And essentially, they cut off relations with the Russian Orthodox Church. But there's a big but here. But they didn't use the mechanism that is recognized by all of the Orthodox that would make them independent through the eyes of the church, and that would be to declare or to ask for autocephaly or complete independence. And because they didn't make that move, but instead used the word independent, which is not a technical term, the Ukrainian government and many Ukrainian citizens continued to suspect them of having an association with the Russian Orthodox Church. And that became a huge problem because of the kind of language that was coming from Patriarch Kirill of Moscow, who repeatedly justified Russia's invasion of Ukraine, referred to the Ukrainian regime in very pejorative terms, and essentially claimed that any Russian soldiers who died on the battlefield would automatically be saved because it would be a justified sacrifice. And so all of this kind of comes into play now, where you have the Russian Orthodox Church, which continues to justify this invasion of Ukraine, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which I would describe as embattled because they were under Russian rule, and now they say they're not, but a lot of Ukrainian people, Ukrainian politicians, and especially the current Ukrainian presidential administration doesn't believe that they're not under Russian influence. And then you have the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, created in 2018 to 2019, which is a truly Ukrainian church. And there are some other players, but these are the main ones. And things are very difficult in interchurch relations right now. They're complicated, they're messy, and there's, at least from my point of view, no good solution in sight for the time being.
Yeah, well, thank you for the very helpful historical contextualization. I know it's a very complex history, and as you suggested, there's probably a whole lot more that could be said. And I think that's really helpful to know kind of some of the ecclesial bodies that are involved. How about some of the kind of main ecclesial actors in this drama that's unfolding between Russia and Ukraine? So for instance, in your book, you talk about three patriarchs in particular whose influence has been especially important. So who are these three patriarchs, and what's been kind of their role in the unfolding drama?
Absolutely. So let me go back in history. The Orthodox church leader who dominated Ukrainian church life and the Ukrainian church scene since 1966. He's still alive. His name is Filaret, and he was appointed to lead the Ukrainian church under Moscow, as I said, in 1966. So he was firmly established within the Soviet system, and he was quite loyal and was an important spokesperson of the Russian Orthodox Church, not only during the Soviet period and within the territory of the Soviet Union, but also in international forums. And he became a lightning rod, first because he was an ethnic Ukrainian who espoused this kind of loyalty to the Soviet Union at first, and also to this notion of the unity of peoples, especially of Ukraine, Russia, and Belarus. And he became a lightning rod for a number of reasons, the most important of which is when Gorbachev permitted the return of the independent Orthodox Ukrainians in 1989, Filaret started by opposing them and by using his position as the leader of the church in Ukraine to try to garner international Orthodox support to snuff that movement out. But that movement, that independent movement, was so strong in Western Ukraine, in particular in Galicia, that he was unable to snuff it out. You immediately had more than 1,000 parishes that become Orthodox and become part of this autocephalous movement in 1989 and 1990, so that by 1991, Filaret tries to get the support of all of the bishops in Ukraine who were under the Russian Orthodox Church to get autocephaly, and he initially succeeds. He gets all of their signatures. They make a request of the synod in the Russian Orthodox Church, first in November of 1991, and then with more force in April of 1992, to grant the Ukrainian Orthodox Church autocephaly, which would presumably have made the autocephalous movement maybe unnecessary, or would have greased the wheels, if you will, to create one unified Ukrainian church. But two things happened that he did not want to happen. The first was that three of his own bishops withdrew their signatures and opposed him, even though there was still a very strong majority in favor of autocephaly. And then second was that in May of 1992, the Synod of the Russian Orthodox Church denied the petition. They called Filaret to Moscow, and they ordered him to retire. And while he was in Moscow, he made an oath that he would retire and allow the election of a new replacement to lead the church in Ukraine. But as soon as he got back to Ukraine, he said that he did so under pressure and that he had no intention of retiring, and had every intention of continuing to move for autocephaly in independent Ukraine. So what happened was that in 1992, immediately after he returned to Ukraine, first, the Russian Orthodox Church deposed him, and that just means that they defrocked him. And that was a way of removing him from power. I would call that the use of soft power, you know, to use a mechanism in church canon law to remove someone from power who is no longer following orders. And, you know, one thing I want to note here is that throughout his career, a number of people have said that he was a terrible character and ruled with cruelty and an iron fist and broke church laws by having a family with children. And many people say, especially, that that last rumor is true, but that they didn't make a formal charge against him for that reason. A second time in 1997, the Russian Orthodox Church anathematized him, which is essentially using the nuclear option to eliminate a figure who one considers troublesome, because if you anathematize them, they're considered to be not even Christian anymore. You know, they're completely cast out of the church altogether. And when they did that, he continued to carry on as the leader of the Kyiv Patriarchate. And so he became the symbol of a subversive character who continued to fight for Ukrainian church independence despite the continued assaults of the Russian Orthodox Church upon him. And in reality, and I have to say that this bothers a lot of people because of his career, which spans, you know, clearly servitude to the Soviet state, time spent in the ranks of the KGB, questionable moral character. Despite all of that, he became the primary architect of what an autocephalous church or an independent church would look like in Ukraine. I don't think he's going to have the final say, but his mark, his fingerprint currently is all over the independent church movement in Ukraine. And he is one of many people who has touched upon it, who has contributed to it. And I think that that church movement is now beginning to evolve in its own direction. But in that sense, he was an important figure. And the second patriarch that I'll mention here had to find a way to deal with Filaret's legacy to make this union of Orthodox Ukrainians possible. And this is Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople. He's an important figure because he was the one person who had some authority to try to solve the church crisis in Ukraine. He came on the scene as early as 1991, before he even became the leader of the Patriarchate of Constantinople, because he visited Kyiv in July 1991. Right on the eve of the declaration of Ukrainian independence. And he was quoted during his visit as taking the approach of wanting to promote dialogue between all parties without casting blame on one another. So he avoided from the outset a partisan approach of basically saying, I'm going to side with the Russian church, or I'm going to take a position against this autocephalous movement. He wanted dialogue. And his role in this remained somewhat quiet during the first part of the post-Soviet period. But it began to gain traction really around the time of the Maidan Revolution of Dignity and afterwards, when the movement for some kind of resolution to these divisions among the Ukrainian churches began to gain momentum, when it became clear that Ukraine was taking a firm step away from Russian dominance in the geopolitical scene. There was pressure on the churches to also take a firm step away from Russian dominance in the church. And in 2015, Patriarch Bartholomew appointed two exarchs to Ukraine to start the process of unifying the churches. In fact, there had been some movement on that front earlier in 2008, but it seemed that the situation in Ukraine, that the people, especially church leaders, weren't quite ready for unification yet. Nevertheless, Patriarch Bartholomew remained active, and it really surprised a lot of Orthodox insiders when he said, I'm going to give autocephaly to the Ukrainian church in 2018. I think his role is important because this was the first time that you have not only an external Orthodox church, but one who essentially bears the highest prestige among all Orthodox churches, who says, I'm going to take action. It's a third party intervening into an affair that had been dominated by Russian and Ukrainian church figures, church actors. So when he made that move, that essentially caused an earthquake in inter-Orthodox relations, because the Russian Orthodox Church completely rejected Patriarch Bartholomew's actions, to the point of they've completely stopped having relations with the church in Constantinople and have now targeted the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople in their media campaign. They've essentially said that that they went far beyond the boundaries of their authority in the actions that they took in Ukraine. And that leads us to the third patriarch, Patriarch Kirill. And he's important here because he was the one who presided over, this is Patriarch Kirill of Moscow. He's the one who's presiding over the Russian Orthodox Church during these epic events. He comes onto the scene in 2009 following the death of Patriarch Alexei II. And in 2009, he visits Ukraine. There is some enthusiasm among Ukrainian clergy and Russian clergy at his enthronement and appointment as Patriarch of Moscow because he was known to be a progressive church leader prior to his appointment as Patriarch. But Patriarch Kirill took a strong conservative turn, and there are a number of scholars who have observed and remarked on this in the field. In the year 2012, first following the challenges that were posed to Vladimir Putin on re-election, and also the Pussy Riot controversy in Moscow, and essentially Patriarch Kirill starts to promulgate a very conservative vision for Orthodoxy at large that would be centered in Moscow. It's known as the Ruski Mir, or the Russian world. Some call it, I like to call it an initiative, because it kind of envisions a space where Orthodox Christians can gather no matter what they are, that adheres to traditional values that Patriarch Kirill claimed were cultivated and passed down throughout the entire history of not only the Russian Empire into the Soviet period and beyond, but also by those principalities of Rus. And a very important staple part of this narrative, of this Russian world initiative, or some call it a myth, is that Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus, and sometimes Moldova, are essentially one people. That the current borders that are drawn to distinguish sovereign states from one another and to delineate territorial integrity have no bearing on the unity that they share, that they're essentially one nation and one people who belong to one church, the Russian Orthodox Church, or the Moscow Patriarchate. And Patriarch Kirill begins to promote this myth, this initiative in Ukraine, and it meets very strong resistance pretty much everywhere. The Ukrainian Greek Catholics resist it, the independent-minded Orthodox resist it, and it even meets resistance within the Ukrainian Orthodox Church that's subordinate to the Russian Orthodox Church. And so he continues to push it, and he meets resistance, and he continues to push this agenda, and pushes it with much more force and passion and polemic following the Maidan Revolution of Dignity in 2013. And it meets even more resistance in Ukraine, even among the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. And he had an opportunity to resolve this issue on numerous occasions by perhaps trying to convene the Orthodox Church leaders in Ukraine and to sit with them to come up with a resolution to their divisions. But instead, he pushed this agenda, and now he finds himself in cahoots with President Putin, really being the person who is the chief spokesperson in favor of this alternative civilization that rejects liberalism, or what one might call illiberal liberalism, European Union values, in particular LGBTQ rights, which is its own complicated topic on the Russian and the Ukrainian religious orbits. And he does so, depending on one's point of view, it seems to most observers that he has lost Ukraine for the Russian Orthodox Church forever, no matter what happens from this point forward, because he essentially used the pulpit, his position as Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church, to justify this war, not only once, but now over the course of the entirety of the war. And it's very hard to see a way out for the Russian Orthodox Church at this point, despite the fact that the Ukrainian church that was under the Russian Orthodox Church hasn't taken that final step towards formal independence or autocephaly, because the Ukrainian people are aware of Patriarch Kirill's justification of the war. And the last thing I'll say about it is that this policy, this myth, this initiative, it is not confined to Russia and Ukraine. It has reverberations far beyond Russia and Ukraine, and it's creating very serious tensions within all of the Orthodox churches throughout the world, where essentially they're finding themselves, where do we stand on this? How do we talk about this with our people? What position do we take on Patriarch Kirill and his controversial stance? So there are a lot of problems associated with it. And these three patriarchal figures, whatever one makes of them, and they all have fans and they all have strong, fierce opponents, all three of them. They're all very important to this day. And I think that that even once their time on this earth is done, that their legacies will continue to reverberate in Ukrainian and Russian political and church relations.
Sure. I mean, it does. Yeah, it certainly seems like these events have really shaken the Orthodox Church on a global scale. I would just say that, like, this is your descriptions are so helpful, especially for those of us from Western traditions who I think by and large were not terribly familiar with Eastern Orthodox history, let alone even who are some of the main figures and church bodies operating today. So thank you again. You also write in your book about not just three patriarchs but two kind of important metropolitans, which this might be a good time, if you want to wrap this into your answer, to explain what a patriarch is versus what a metropolitan is, sort of what each of these functions are within Orthodoxy, and maybe their relationship to one another as well. But the main thrust of the question is who are these two metropolitans you talk about, and what have been kind of each of their roles in the ongoing tensions between Ukraine and Russia?
Absolutely. So a patriarch is the chief leader of an independent or autocephalous Orthodox Church. So Patriarch Kirill is the leader of the entire Russian Orthodox Church. He's also the bishop of Moscow. Now there you can have metropolitans within a patriarchate. And so those metropolitans would not be the leader of a completely independent church, but they'd be a leader of like a diocese. But there can be a metropolitan that's a leader of an entire Orthodox Church if that church has not been given the dignity of a patriarchate yet. And that's where the difference comes into play. So Metropolitan Epifani is the leader of the Orthodox Church of Ukraine. And he's the bishop of Kyiv, but he's the leader of those 8,000 some parish communities, Orthodox communities in Ukraine, who essentially oversees all of church life and convenes the other bishops to meet, to discuss issues, to make declarations. So he's the chief overseer of the whole church, although his authority is not binding over the whole church. That's different from Metropolitan Onufri, although with the recent changes that have been made in their church life, that's kind of an arguable issue. Prior to May 2022, the Metropolitan of the Ukrainian Church that was under Moscow was subordinate to the Patriarch of Moscow and was also on the Synod of the Russian Orthodox Church. And while that remains formally true today, Metropolitan Onufri of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, some 12,000 plus parishes, so quite a large church community dispersed throughout all of Ukraine. The Metropolitan Onufri, depending on one's point of view, from their point of view, from their official point of view, he is the leader of the church, subordinate to no one. I would say that most of the Orthodox in the world would say that he is still subordinate to the Russian Orthodox Church. So depending on the definition of the statute of the Orthodox Church, a metropolitan can oversee the entire church without being subordinate to any foreign patriarch or other church leader, or can be part of a larger patriarchal structure. And again, the difference between the two, an Orthodox church that's autocephalous is not deficient or lesser in any way to one, if it's a metropolia, it's not deficient. It just doesn't have the dignity of patriarch or patriarchate. And that status doesn't make one more authoritative or give one more power. It has to do with history and politics and sometimes size. So, you know, there's been some discussion among Orthodox Ukrainians that they might want at some point to make the Orthodox Church of Ukraine into a patriarchate. Moving to these figures, we'll start with Metropolitan Onufri of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. He has quite the history. First, when he was a bishop, he was one of those three bishops who withdrew his signature from the request for independence or autocephaly that was made in 1992 by Filaret to the Russian Orthodox Church. He has a lot of fans, a lot of proponents. He has a reputation for being a good preacher, for serving the divine services with beauty and with dignity. A lot of people like him. He preaches simply and makes the message of the gospel accessible to ordinary people. He does so in quite beautiful, lyrical Ukrainian and Russian. But he's been somewhat of a powder keg figure because of his, he's got two things in his history that kind of ruffled the feathers of many Ukrainians. First, back in 2008, when Ukrainians were remembering the genocidal famine that Stalin imposed upon Ukraine in 1932 to 1933 that killed 3 to 5 million people and was part of his larger collectivization and dekulakization program, Onufri said in public remarks in 2008 that this was punishment for the sins that the Ukrainian people had committed, and that ruffled a lot of feathers of the world. And, you know, it was kind of something that people then associated with him as time elapsed. In his church career, he eventually, after the death of his predecessor, Metropolitan Volodymyr, in 2014, he was elected and appointed Metropolitan of Kyiv, and he found himself right in the midst of this powder keg of Ukrainian rejection of Russia, Russian aggression in Donbas, the annexation of Crimea, and this new urgency for religious organizations and churches to find more unity and to support the Ukrainian government in their struggle against Russian aggression. Well, in 2015, he and two other bishops of his church attend a session in parliament with the president where a moment of silence where everyone stands in honor of Ukrainian soldiers who died in the struggle is invoked. And they are the only three people who remain seated. And it came out later that they were seated to protest this moment of silence, and it, you know, became very notorious. Why did they do that? It's very controversial. And the response that they gave is, we're against war. You know, we have Christian people who are within our church, who are under our pastoral care in Donbas, and we have to care for them too. And this anti-war position, what seemingly neutral position, but especially the refusal to condemn Russian aggression put Metropolitan Onufri and the rest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church under fire, but also very much under the suspicious eye of the Ukrainian government. Like, what is this? Why are they remaining neutral? Why won't they condemn Russian aggression? That became a real problem for this church when Russia invaded Ukraine, because it made it look like, boy, were they wrong. It made it look like that. Boy, were they wrong the whole time. And to, you know, Metropolitan Onufri, a few days after the missiles struck and Russian troops were boots on the ground in Ukrainian territory, he condemned the invasion. He called upon Putin to put a stop to it. And he was the main architect of this council on May 27th, 2022, that took a big step away from the Russian Orthodox Church. But he remains, I think, embattled and very much in the spotlight in Ukrainian church politics because they haven't taken additional moves away from the Russian Orthodox Church to, you know, the question remains on, are they under Russian influence? Are they collaborating with Russia? And it's very controversial. The Ukrainian government has performed acts that are highly questionable in essentially, you know, trying to put state pressure on the Ukrainian Orthodox Church to end their association, to declare their autocephaly, and especially to unify with the Orthodox Church of Ukraine. So Onufri has been in and out of the spotlight on a number of occasions, but I want to say that he has remained resilient in his position, and he still has a lot of fans throughout the world. He has a lot of supporters throughout the world. His reputation is not good among many Ukrainians because of the previous anti-war stance and the incomplete steps taken away from Russian support or subordination to Russia, but he still has fans and supporters throughout the world. Metropolitan Epifani was also, I think, put in a tough position. He's the leader of the Orthodox Church of Ukraine. I think he's in a tough position because he had to oversee church life in a new church, which had kind of low expectations. There were questions. He was unknown. A lot of Orthodox were unsure of how to regard, how to associate with this new Orthodox church. Many kind of remain on the fence. A few of the other Orthodox churches don't want to have anything to do with the Orthodox Church of Ukraine. So Metropolitan Epifani, he was put in the spotlight, and you know, there was a lot of questioning of how effective of a leader he would be in these new circumstances. And he has certainly adopted, well, let me just throw in there that there was a very strong challenge to his leadership made within months of his election, because the former Patriarch Filaret was made an honorary member of the Synod. And just a few months into it, he began to claim authority that the church never gave to him. This was Filaret. And there was this question of, well, how is Epifani going to handle all of this? Well, Epifani handled it in such a way as to criticize the actions of Filaret, but to not take canonical or not to impose any canonical penalties on him. So Filaret himself left the OCU just after a few months and tried to reconstitute the Kyiv Patriarchate. And Epifani has remained the leader of the Orthodox Church of Ukraine during this time. And he has, I think that his messaging has been very much one of expressing the solidarity of Jesus as the suffering servant, as the rejected Messiah with the suffering Ukrainian people. That has very much been his message. He has certainly, the Orthodox Church of Ukraine as a whole has received some privilege, first with the Poroshenko administration and then after the Russian invasion of Ukraine from the Zelensky administration, because of their open rejection of the Russian Orthodox Church, of their public appeal for Patriarch Kirill to be brought on charges of heresy by the Orthodox patriarchs, of their public, very strong public support of the Ukrainian efforts to defeat and to hold back in the Russian invasion and to restore Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity. You know, the questions, I think, surrounding Metropolitan Epifani, right, let me add one more thing. He also led the charge for the decision of the Orthodox Church of Ukraine to move from the so-called old Julian calendar to the so-called new calendar, which is a revised Julian calendar, which means that for most holidays, those holidays will be celebrated with the rest of the Christian world and some of the Orthodox world, which is most important for Christmas. So Ukrainians who have been celebrating Christmas on January 7th for their entire lives, many of them now will be celebrating Christmas on December 25th. The date for Easter remains the same. That method of calculating the date for Easter hasn't changed. But that was an important step for him to show independence from the Russian Orthodox Church, and also a willingness to kind of take pulse of the feelings of the Ukrainian people, and especially the people under his pastoral care. My own sense is he able to reach across those divided lines, those lines which divide Orthodox Ukrainians, and to try to find some common ground with the Orthodox who remain under Metropolitan Onufri? And I think that's a question, you know, can they find points of agreement? Can they end some of their divisions? Can he be the one who can show a way to, you know, make a gesture of reconciliation? That's an open question, in my opinion. We don't know the answer to that question yet. And during wartime, that issue becomes quite complicated because of the emotions that come with war and the suspicion surrounding the Ukrainian Orthodox Church that had such a long history of association with and subordination to the Russian Orthodox Church, which is under Onufri's governance today.
Sure. Yeah, I think one of the major things I learned in reading your book were that two events that were very significant, or have been very significant, in the last decade, kind of in this history between the Orthodox in Russia and in Ukraine, are the 2013 Maiden Revolution of Dignity, but also the ecumenical patriarchates under the headship of Bartholomew, their creation of the Orthodox Church in Ukraine in 2018. So could you say a bit about these two events? And then also kind of their import or their importance in ecclesial, both ecclesial and kind of political relations between Russia and Ukraine in the last decade.
Absolutely. So in 2013, you have protesters who gather on Independence Square in Ukraine, and that square is known as the Maidan. It's in Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine. And they're protesting then President Viktor Yanukovych's decision to not enter into an association agreement with the European Union and instead to enter into an economic alliance with Russia. And that protest becomes a full-blown revolution because the riot police end up firing on and using violence against protesters that begin with younger people and students, and then you know, becomes populated by veterans of the war in Afghanistan, family members of these students who are absolutely aghast at Yanukovych's willingness to fire upon his own people. That Maidan Revolution of Dignity was Ukrainian, and we, you know, we have to say that not all Ukrainian citizens supported the Maidan Revolution. But like so many revolutions, those who did essentially signal a strong turn away from Russian dominance into Europe, meaning that Ukraine wants to become a part of Europe. And it's so important to note, and this is very well documented, that the Russian political leadership of the Kremlin and the Putin administration, and the most important people in the Russian Orthodox Church, including many ordinary clergy, viewed the Ukrainians who supported the Maidan Revolution of Dignity as traitors. This decisive step away from Russia and to Europe was viewed as a stab in the back. It's very well documented. And this becomes a pivotal turning point for Ukraine, because Ukraine is clearly trying to really seize and claim and make its own independent course, one that is free of strong Russian influence at best and Russian domination at worst with the Maidan Revolution. And for the Ukrainian churches, it's a pivotal point for them to say, how do we stand with the Ukrainian people? How do we signal our support of the Ukrainian people at this pivotal moment? And for the Orthodox churches, is the status quo of, well, we're not united and one of us is part of the Russian Orthodox Church, is that sustainable over the long run? And what happens is that when the Ecumenical Patriarchate creates the Orthodox Church of Ukraine in 2018, for the church, that's kind of like the second final step of a final turn away from Russia, of essentially saying, we have taken this movement for church independence to the point that we now have supporters within the larger family of Orthodox churches in the world. And we're going to chart our own church course away from Russian Orthodox dominance as well. And one of the reasons that this is important, I'll actually say two reasons that this is important. One is because the Russian political leadership viewed the creation of the Orthodox Church of Ukraine as a security threat to Russia. We can easily see this in public statements made by Dmitry Peskov, Sergei Lavrov, and President Putin himself, who viewed this as a threat to Russian-speaking people in Ukraine and to Russia as part of a larger American-led conspiracy. And the second point is the Ecumenical Patriarchate's intervention in Ukrainian church affairs failed to resolve the existing tensions among Orthodox in Ukraine and kind of fanned the flames there. And so in a certain sense, there's unfinished business to this day among the Orthodox in Ukraine, and in particular between the Orthodox Church of Ukraine and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. So that move of creating the Orthodox Church of Ukraine was weighty. It had a significant impact on both the geopolitical arena and also on the intra-Orthodox church arena. And some might even say with ecumenical relations, because then churches like the Roman Catholic Church have to figure out how do they relate to this new Orthodox Church of Ukraine. So it had an impact on a number of levels, very important events, pivotal events in Ukrainian history and in Ukrainian church history.
Yeah, so obviously these two events have huge importance in the last decade, but surely there's more as well as to why the Russian Orthodox Church would decide to kind of justify Russia's invasion of Ukraine, right? You spoke about this with Patriarch Kirill. So, I mean, beyond just kind of these two events, why would you say that they took this stance rather than kind of condemning the invasion or trying to find some other course of action to respond to the invasion?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So in terms of their justification of the war, I think that what you see, let's take, for example, the speech that is well known that was delivered by President Putin in July 2021, when he essentially claimed that Ukraine is a invention and is not really a nation, but that Ukrainians, Russians, and Belarusians are truly one people. And here you see an attempt to manipulate the history of peoples that becomes part of a larger ideological platform to justify invasion. They're really a part of us, and so we're going to force them to be a part of us. That's where this ideological platform fits in. And it had been going on a lot longer, a lot earlier than 2021. What's important is that that speech that Putin gave has very strong resonance in this Russian world ideology, mythology that we've talked about before, where Patriarch Kirill has been saying over and over again that Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus are essentially part of one people, one nation who belong to one church, and which has an indivisibility that no one can fracture or divide from external pressures. And what I think happened was a couple of different things. First is that you have rank and file Russian politicians, Russian Orthodox clergy, Russian Orthodox faithful, Russian citizens who believe this version of a meta-narrative, that these are really one people and that there's no reason for them to be separated. That's one part of it. The second part of it goes back to the Maidan Revolution of Dignity. That generated such hatred. And here I'm going to cite a scholar, Mikhail Suslov, who has written somewhat extensively on where you can find examples of this kind of hatred towards Ukrainians for stabbing Russia in the back by taking this decisive turn away from Russia. And this permeates fairly deeply into the fabric and the population of the Russian Orthodox Church, so that clergy who are on blogs and using social media are using hateful language to describe the Ukrainian people. So this kind of fear and hatred of Ukrainians turning away from Russia leads to a demonization. And this demonization leads to the justification to invade, to defend Russia from these threats that are encroaching upon it. So that's one part of it, is that you have people like Patriarch Kirill and other important figures in the Russian Orthodox Church who believe in this mythology of a single people, this notion of betrayal. But another part of it, though, and I think this is not enough discussed, and it's somewhat recent, not completely, is when Russia invaded Ukraine, Putin said it was a denazification program. He went right for this kind of a historical recreation of the current neighbor as being the Nazi, the new Nazi, the neo-Nazi. Ironically, a country ruled over by a secular Jew, right? I mean, it's really an ugly paradox in this accusation that Putin makes. But he makes this accusation. And what we find is that the Russian Orthodox Church, in its official language, occasionally uses the language of Ukrainian Nazis. And more recently, with the Ukrainian government kind of taking this risky step of investigating the Ukrainian Orthodox Church for evidence of collaboration, the Russian Orthodox Church has now, on a public forum, decreed that the current Ukrainian government is an enemy of the Orthodox Church and is essentially the heir of the Bolshevik regime. And so the language that's coming out from the Russian church about the Ukrainian regime and Ukrainian supporters of the defense this fight for Ukrainian territorial integrity, that they're both neo-Nazis and heirs to the Bolsheviks. And so you see how all of this folds into a demonization campaign. My own sense is, in reviewing the literature and in listening in conversation with other experts on this issue, is that there is enough of a critical mass of Russian citizens, of Russian people, of Russian Orthodox faithful who view Ukrainians more or less to this degree. I'm certainly not saying that everyone does, not at all, but that there are enough that this view of Ukrainians as neo-Nazis, as threats to Russia, as threats to Orthodoxy, where Russia has to then take the lead to defend Orthodoxy, both at the metaphysical level and also on the battlefield, and as being neo-Bolsheviks as well, has some traction within Russian circles. And again, I want to make it very clear that I'm not painting the whole here. That's not, it has enough traction in Russian circles that the Russian Orthodox Church has made a decision to use its public platform at the international level to make these claims.
You have alluded a lot to kind of the earthquake that these events have set off on a more global scale for, all the different Orthodox communities. So I'm very curious kind of how other Orthodox around the world, other Orthodox figures, other Orthodox communities have sort of responded to the Russian Orthodox Church's support of Russia's invasion. And obviously, I know this is probably also a very complex picture, but if you could just say a little bit about kind of how other Orthodox around the globe have responded.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So in terms of the invasion itself, there is a great deal, some consensus, I think. Well, okay, let me back that up. So you'll want to edit this part.
Okay.
Among Orthodox churches throughout the world, there are some Orthodox churches that have condemned the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Russian aggression, the atrocities that have been committed, and called for an end to the war, to the invasion itself. There are some churches that have taken a more cautious approach that tried to express support for Ukraine without implicating Russia in any obvious way, and calling for a peaceful resolution as soon as possible and an end to hostilities. I don't really know of many churches that have come out and endorsed the invasion. There are certainly individual priests and bishops who have climbed aboard the bandwagon of endorsing the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But in terms of a church itself, you'll either have a condemnation of the Russian invasion or some kind of lament expressed at the war between these two countries and a call for an end to it. Really, in terms of criticism of Patriarch Kirill and the Russian Orthodox Church, we've only seen it from the churches in Ukraine, the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople, and to a certain degree, the Patriarchate of Alexandria and Africa, and the Orthodox Church in Greece. That's pretty much it. There has been a real reluctance to publicly criticize or to condemn Patriarch Kirill. That now, in terms of laity, that's a different story. Orthodox laity have come out both within Ukraine and outside of Ukraine to condemn Patriarch Kirill. In fact, over 500 theologians signed a document declaring the Russian world or Ruski Mir ideology to be heretical and have called for Patriarch Kirill to be called to account for his support and promulgation of this ideological platform.
What would you say is next for kind of the global Orthodox churches. So, I mean, in your book, for example, you lay out kind of three big suggestions for the global Orthodox churches to kind of undertake for peace and reconciliation between Russia and Ukraine. So what are those three suggestions? And then just with kind of an eye looking forward, what would you say is kind of next or should be undertaken on behalf of the situation?
In response to your question, I think that what the Orthodox need to undertake is to be more deliberate and intentional in their actions. A couple of things that I would like to see is for the Orthodox to take seriously not only the declaration of the 500 plus theologians who condemned the Russian world ideology, but also to support the hundreds of priests who are part of Metropolitan Onufri's Ukrainian Orthodox Church, who have also called for a tribunal for Patriarch Kirill. This is a very serious accusation. And when you have that much of a critical mass of clergy and laity who are calling for a tribunal or at least an investigation of a patriarch who is supporting a war that involves war crimes and the forced deportation of children, the rest of the Orthodox Church needs to take that seriously. They can't just play the ostrich and put their head into the ground. They have to take that seriously. So I think that they have to try to find a mechanism to move the needle on this accusation. And the second thing that I think that the Orthodox need to do is that they need to be much more proactive about trying to find a way to reconcile the Orthodox churches in Ukraine. That is the most obvious solution to this crisis, is for those two churches to either unite, and there have been a number of proposals that I think are at least, you know, at the eye level, at the level of what it might look like initially, plausible, or to at least come to peace with one another so that their faithful could share communion with one another. There needs to be more Orthodox action on that. There's too much turning away from and basically saying that we don't need to get involved. I think this exposes a general Orthodox weakness or deficiency that respects independence so much that it's at the expense of interdependence. And some support from these Orthodox churches to say, we recognize that this is an important part of the crisis. We're not going to ignore it. You're all part of the body of Christ. And this part of the body of Christ is deeply afflicted and wounded. And as the body of Christ outside of Ukraine, we're going to do what we can to help mend you, to help you come to healing. That would be an important gesture. And Orthodox have had a tendency to kind of say, well, you know, we don't want to get involved and therefore we're going to maintain the status quo. The current status quo is contributing to a humanitarian catastrophe. Hmm. And it has reached beyond Ukraine. You know, these kinds of games that are being played with grain exports are affecting people far outside of Ukraine who depend on that grain. And so I think the Orthodox need to be more proactive and intentional and deliberate about finding ways to make peace. And one of the ways to do that would be to say that we're going to support all of the Orthodox in Ukraine, not to mention all of the people of Ukraine, but all of the Orthodox in Ukraine. And we're going to reach out a loving Christian hand to them and to do everything that we can to promote healing and reconciliation and unification among them.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so kind of zooming out from our conversation and as we kind of come to a close, what's next for you and your work? Is there anything you'd like to plug?
Yeah, thank you. I'm speaking a lot, presenting on my book. I'm doing so happily. I'm presenting at Valparaiso University this coming month, and in a number of other conferences that are upcoming. In terms of looking ahead, I'm excited about a couple of projects. One project is a pretty fundamental one, which is to just write a basics book on orthodoxy for Rutledge Press or Rutledge Publishing. But the other one that I'm excited about is I'm going to be looking at alternative Ukrainian notions of churchliness. And it's got a better title than that, but basically, what might Ukrainian Orthodoxy look like in the future if we take a look at the entirety of its history and how its primary protagonists, how its main leaders and architects have envisioned what a Ukrainian church might look like that's different from this Russian world ideology? That's a project I hope to start this coming January, and I'm really looking forward to taking that on because, as far as I know, there's nothing in English that addresses that issue, and I'm excited about taking that work on.
Sure, yeah, it sounds very, very interesting. Okay, where can our listeners find you? Are you online anywhere?
I'm on Facebook and Instagram and on Twitter, and I hope to continue to expand my digital media presence in the near future to be even more accessible. But I can be found on those social media platforms right now, and I'll be posting some of my talks and as I am able, recordings and blog posts and other ways that I'm commenting on my work and updating it on those platforms in the near future.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, thank you very much, Professor Denisenko. This has been a really, really informative conversation. I appreciate you taking some time.
Thank you, Zechariah, for the opportunity today, and all my best to the good work that you're doing with the Theology Mill podcast at Cascade. Mm-hmm.